And I said to the policeman in Hebrew, help this boy. And they said to me, why are you talking about? He's an Arab.
These are messages coming into me right now from people in Gaza.
He told us when the soldiers come, they wake everybody up and herd them into a kitchen for hours while soldiers sleep in their bedrooms.
This whole idea that Jews and Arabs have been enemies, I mean, that's like just, it's modern propaganda to kind of justify.
Because this is over 1,000 years of mothers teaching their children, grow up and kill Jews.
In the Muslim world, Jews thrived. It was a golden age. We Jews talk about the golden age of Spain.
It's time that Gaza ends. The 2 million people who live there, they are clever assassins. They need to be removed from that land. That land needs to be turned into a national park.
About Herzl, he was thinking about Christians.
Hmm.
Annihilating Jews.
What's your response to that? That's the narrative that's painted, that for over 1,000 years, Muslim mothers teaching their children hate Jews, eradicate Jews.
Completely untrue. It's absolutely untrue.
And that is my next guest, Rabbi. That's right, Rabbi David Mivaser.
I first went to Israel as a 19-year-old young man, trying to find my place in the world, coming to a place where I felt like, whoa, you know, like Israel, that's like my people's country. Very first week, maybe the second or third day, I was in Jerusalem. I was walking down a street that's called Jaffa Street. It goes from the Jaffa Gate to Jaffa, and there's nice old stone shops and stuff. And there was a little boy, maybe 6 or 7 year old boy, bleeding from his hand. He must have cut his hand on a broken bottle. Bleeding and crying, and there was two policemen there. So I went to the boy and I said, you know, come with me. And I took him to the policeman and I said to the policeman in Hebrew, help this boy. And they said to me, why are you talking about? He's an Arab, you know, just get rid of him. So that was my first experience.
Rabbi David
Mivaser, and you know, I just want, right here in the beginning, I can say it's a cognate or related word with Bishara,
mm-hmm,
or Bashir, or Basr, right? In Arabic, it's a Hebrew word that means a messenger bringing good news.
Beautiful, beautiful. And this is what really captivated me, the story you are sharing. And there's another part to it I want to go ahead and emphasize. This is the part that stuck out. And I want people at home to really like replace this word Arab with the next word that we're going to go ahead and have people listen to. And then they can really, maybe this can really hit home.
Mm-hmm. If he said the N-word, right? Mm-hmm. Please forgive me. Mm-hmm. But I'm just trying to say, just replace Arab with the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah. Exactly.
How repulsed will we be?
Yeah, it's disgusting. Get this.
He's an Arab. He's an Arab. You know, just get rid of him.
So disgusting. That's what's happening to the people over there. This is how, mm-hmm, they're treated.
Exactly.
Is this, so this is the story. This is where your journey started to where you are today. Tell us a little bit about yourself for people who don't know about you. And then we can get into kind of the story that I was sharing with the audience.
You know, I want to like actually replace what you just did, which was completely right. But right now, what I'm hearing is people being driven out of their homes, being displaced, many of them being killed. What if we went back 80 years ago and replaced the word Arab with Jew, right?
Mm.
I mean, what was going on in the early 1940s when Nazis were rampaging across Europe and driving Jewish people out of their homes, rounding them up in these tiny little places full of disease with no food, no water, and intending actually to exterminate them. You know, you could have gone farther with what you just did in that little segment, which I understand, like that was like for an American audience to hear that word. But when I see what's going on today, what I see is the history that I grew up with, which was totally the Holocaust. And I can say at that time, I don't know how much people were aware of what was going on in the world. You know, did they know what was happening in real time? I think largely it wasn't really known until afterwards. I don't know. That's history. My point is right now we see what's happening in real time. And I think we're feeling very impotent to do anything about it. So anyway, that's just what's right on top for me. Like right now, while I'm sitting here, I don't know if you hear these little sounds coming from my computer going, boing, boing, boing. These are messages coming into me right now from people in Gaza. There are
right
two
now.
Women in Maghazi camp. One of them is 24-year-old mother of two who I've been in touch with for about 4 years and helping her provide literally food for her children for these years. And the other one is a woman who's an amazing woman. She has 4 children and she's also there. And I've only been in touch with her since October 7th when things got so horrible. Mm-hmm. But they're both writing to me in the last hour or two telling me they are being driven out and there's nowhere to go.
So you're literally right now getting messages from Gaza. How are they able to communicate? We heard like the internet, they shut everything down. How are they still able
to? It's off and on. I mean, yeah, they'll be in touch for a while and then they're just gone, you know? And it feels like it's really important when you can be in touch with them to connect, you know? Part of, I think, obviously the little bits of money that we send them help them buy food and water, and all this started in a time when they didn't even need warm clothes, you know, and now they do. Anyway, there's so much that they need and the little bits of money that we send help them. But besides that, for a lot of people, being in touch with someone who's outside of that situation, who knows what's going on with them. Here's another one, like really, really,
in real time. That's amazing. In real time, you're getting messages from Palestine, from Gaza.
It sustains them. You know, it makes, like, there's so many things from the Holocaust where people wrote on like little pieces of paper and like stuck it in a crack in the wall saying, if only someone knew what was happening to us. Right? Or they'd write it on a little, like just like scroll it on the wall. Like when this is over, someone will find this and they'll know what happened to us.
We got it in 4K.
What's happening right now?
Live. The whole world's seeing it.
Yes. Yes.
It's tell me, let's go back to this story. Yes. This story when I first watched this.
He's an Arab. You know, just get rid of him.
I was like, wow. So you went back. And you were going back, you lived in Israel, and now this is kind of what kicked it off. Yeah. And then there were other events, but take us back to that story. Let's revisit that story.
Okay, so I grew up in America in a very, you know, comfortable, reasonably easy life in the late 1960s. And as I got more and more interested in my own Jewish identity and who am I as a young, you know, young man growing up in this world and really seeing myself as a Jew, where's my place in the world? Where do I belong? Like, it was good to get born in America and grow up there. It made life a lot easier than most other places, but I didn't feel like that was really my place in the world. I don't actually belong there in some essential way. That country of America doesn't belong to me. You know, this land is your land. This land is my land. It's like, not really. We are the beneficiaries of a genocide. That's why we're there. So where do I belong? And everything I knew kind of pointed back to the land of the Bible, the land where my ancestors lived, the land where the Jewish kings were kings and where our prophets were. So I, 18, 19 years old, I thought, I'll go there, I'll check it out, and was full of idealism about it. So that's like some background. And then when I went, it was 1971, the story that you're asking me to retell a bit is when I first was in Jerusalem, which was like magical, amazing, beautiful, unbelievable kind of place. There was an incident where maybe second or third day I was there. I'll just retell the story. I was on a very nice street full of old shops, you know, stone buildings and just beautiful. And there was this little boy who was bleeding out of his hand and crying. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I'll try to help this little kid. And there were two policemen standing right nearby. So I gently took the little boy to the policeman. And I
in
said,
in Hebrew, help, you were speaking in Hebrew, right?
I learned Hebrew. And this policeman were like, they were like, what?
He's an Arab. He's an Arab. You know, just get rid of him.
He's an Arab. Like, just get rid of him. And that was, honestly, that was my introduction to, you could say, the other side of Israel. So I lived with an ideal, a kind of romantic vision of Israel. And actually, you know, one reason I was telling that story is because it took me decades of my life to integrate what I saw right before my eyes. Decades. Like I told, what I was just telling you was when I was 19 years old, I think I passed age 50, maybe got close to 60 before I could integrate into my overall concept of Israel what was really going on there. I read the history. I knew that the Jews threw out the Arabs, demolished their homes, erased their villages. I saw right before my eyes piles of rubble that were Palestinian villages. I knew that. It wasn't a matter of cognitively not knowing it. It was a matter of integrating it into my conception of what's going on. And I'm saying this because it takes people a very, very long time to let go of the stories that we tell ourselves that mean so much and kind of shape who we are, right? That story that I was telling myself about Israel,
do you think it's
a story about myself? And to let go of that was such a major reorientation.
What triggered me about that story, what was fascinating is that humanity, like just the child, the innocent child, your humanity was on and you wanted to help this child. But then you took them over to the proper authorities and as a fair assessment, had they lost their humanity? We're trying, and by our intention here is to get people to keep the humanity on. I mean, we condemn the killing of any innocent human being. All human life is precious. This is without a doubt. All human life, not just some life, all human life. Yeah. So we want to get people on the same page with this. And then when we, and never again.
Well, like, isn't that one of the purposes of religion? Doesn't every religion teach that? Yeah. Right. And then they get distorted and corrupted and perverted. So it ends up when you say they lost their humanity. Oh, they're so kind and helpful to other Jews or people they think are Jews, but they wall off everybody else. And, you know, with all respect for other people's religions, I think in practice that happens a lot, you know. Happens a lot where the religion turns into like an in-group versus the out-group.
Now you talk about, for our audience who don't know this term, cognitive dissonance, when you went through it for a long time and that was a catalyst from that moment. So cognitive dissonance, the state of having inconsistent thoughts, this is one of the definition, beliefs or attitudes, especially as relating to behavioral decisions and attitude exchange. Some examples given are you want to be healthy, but you don't exercise regularly or eat nutritious food. You feel guilty as a result. You know that smoking, drinking is harmful to your health, but you do it anyway. In the field of psychology, cognitive dissonance is the perception of contradictory information and the mental toll of it. So this was your state for a long time. How can we unpackage this that people who want to have their humanity on, they don't have to go through such a long time while we're seeing right 4K innocent children, innocent human beings being going through a genocide. Would you say this is a genocide?
It is. It doesn't matter whether I say it or not, but it is. Israel is indiscriminately killing thousands of people simply because of how Israel identifies them, right? They're Gazans, they're Palestinians, they're Arabs, and they're just getting killed. And also, it's very clear that Israel is removing them, erasing them from the place where they've been living. And it's over 2 million people. I expect they're going to be pushed out of there. And we need to remember, why are they even there in the first place? Mm-hmm. Something like 80% of the people in Gaza are the children and grandchildren of people who were pushed into Gaza in 1948 when their homes were destroyed. They were driven out of their homes in 1948. And then the Israelis dynamited them, bulldozed them, wiped them off the face of the earth. So they would have nowhere to come back to. That's explicit. And that gets called the Nakba.
And the Nakba.
The Nakba. And it's a continuous process that began in 47 and 48. But we're seeing it, as you've said a couple times. I don't know what 4K means, but we're seeing it in
4K. Like you have 1080, you have, this is the different HD. That's like the top in HD.
Okay, that's not my field of expertise. But the point is, this is happening right now in real time. I just said, time, I'm getting messages right now, within the last hour, from two women with children who haven't been able to eat for 2 months. Being driven out of their homes. And when you say, is this a genocide? I don't want to get pedantic. I mean, you can look it up in a dictionary or go to some, you know, international law. Like, what is genocide? This is it. It's happening. And for Americans, it's being paid for with our tax dollars.
Wow.
And given a, you know, diplomatic cover, political cover. Mm-hmm. It's happening right now.
Tell me, let's go back in history. You mentioned 1948. I'm going to play another clip. And this is by one of a leading figure in America. It's a Christian. And there it goes with this narrative. So we want to unpackage this narrative and see how false, true this is.
We can no longer embrace this being Mr. Nice Guy to the people who are in Gaza. Because this is over 1,000 years of mothers teaching their children, grow up and kill Jews. Grow up and kill Jews.
Now, when you hear that as a Jewish rabbi, what do you say to that? The narratives that she's repeating is that it's been over for 1,000 years. Muslim mothers, Palestinian mothers are teaching their children to hate Jews, to eradicate Jews. What's your response to that?
Completely untrue. It's absolutely untrue. This, first of all, this conflict only began a little more than 100 years ago. It began because of Zionism declaring that it's going to take this land away. That's why that began. And it's certainly not 1,000 years. And during the past 1,000 years, many, many Jews who needed to flee from their homes were taken in by Arabs and by Muslims. Even in Gaza, there were Jews in past centuries who fled to what we call Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. And the place where they went was Gaza, and they were taken in. That's known. There are rabbis in Gaza. Nobody killed them.
Wow. So this is and this is confirmed. I've interviewed other rabbis and they've also testified to this historically. So where is she getting this? Well, I mean, because there was relative peace for over 1,000 years.
Sure. You just said, where does she get it? So go back to that concept of cognitive dissonance. And I want to apply it to this situation. So most people want to believe that the people who they identify with and they are a part of are good people and they do good in the world, right? We want to think that about ourselves in the plural. And if the evidence is to the contrary, and right before your eyes, you see that that's not true. Cognitive dissonance means you can't hold both of those things in your mind at the same time. You can't say we are good people and we're doing evil. That doesn't fit. So one or the other of those things needs to go. And if you're very attached to the idea that we are good people, then you have to get rid of the evidence. You have to like sweep it under the rug and not believe it, and even overwhelm it with something else. So I would just propose the kind of armchair psychologist that that woman and many, many people like her can't accept that their people are doing something so horrible. So the psychological defense against that is to say like, oh, those people, the ones we're doing it to, they're really the problem. They're the ones who hate. They're the ones that kill, and so on and so on. And we're hearing that over and over again. This is very complex. I don't say that as an excuse to not deal with it, but just right now, something we hear over and over and over is on October 7th, yes, Hamas fighters broke through the fence that they had been enclosed in for 16 years. Most of them were not much more than 16 years old, you know. They broke through the fence and they attacked Israelis and they killed hundreds. They committed atrocities. And that is just used over and over and over and over again as a kind of justification, which it's not, for committing even greater atrocities. I'm just saying that's a dynamic. Why does that woman need to insist on something that is so completely untrue? It's like a psychological cover. Mm. I think it's not a political argument. Right, there's no truth to it, but it can make her feel okay about the people who she identifies with, whether she's Jewish or not. I don't know who she is, but she identifies with that. So for her, it's okay to do what we see Israel doing, because those people are such monsters.
And just one more piece of information I want to go ahead and just to drive this point home. This is another academic, Jewish academic, regarding this question and this issue, this narrative that they're painting. I want to go ahead and play this.
Jews under medieval Islam never suffered from the same general negative perception as in Christian West. Despite regional variations and high medieval political instability in medieval Islam, multicultural environments combined with active engagement in science and literature led to something of an Islamic golden age for the Jews, at least according to most historical accounts. It has been primarily in the context of recent political developments that the once assumed positive views of Jewish life under medieval Islam have been seriously questioned.
And this is from the professor, Dean Philip Bell, professor of history at Separatist Institute.
Separatist Institute is a Jewish college in Chicago.
It's a Jewish college in Chicago. Do you know this professor?
I don't know him actually, but more importantly is what he said is undeniably true. Absolutely. Yeah. Anybody who knows, like, say, Jewish liturgy, meaning the kind of body of prayers that we say in the worship, would know that our most beautiful, like, hymns and poems, we call it piyut, were written in the Muslim world. Jews thrived. It was a golden age. We Jews talk about the golden age of Spain that was several centuries under Muslim rule. And it came to an end, actually, when the Christians conquered the Muslims and pushed them out. Oh, yeah, sure. All this stuff is being used politically and distorted. But anyone who has a shred of knowledge about the development of Jewish life knows about, say, the golden age in Spain.
Well, beautiful.
I could go so much farther than that. I mean, many of the people listening might have heard of Maimonides. I think in Arabic he's called Al-Maimuni.
Rambam? Is that
Rambam?
Rambam.
Thank you.
Rambam.
Yeah, you did that very well. Rambam, which stands for Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon.
Tell us about him, yes.
Well, what I want to say, there's an expression saying from Moshe to Moshe, there was none like Moshe, meaning from Moses the prophet in the Bible until Moses ben Maimon, Rambam or Al-Maimuni, there was no one that great. He was that great. He was like the leading Jewish philosopher and so on. He also was a physician. I'll just say a few more things. So he was born in Andalus in Spain under Muslim rule, which went on for centuries, and it was a beautiful multicultural kind of environment. I've even seen pictures of tombs of kings that engraved on the tomb is Arabic, Latin, and Hebrew. I mean, that's how multicultural it was. The tomb of the king has those three languages. Anyway, so Maimonides was born there. His family was driven out. They went to Morocco. And eventually he went and settled in Cairo, and he became the physician to the caliph in Cairo. But the thing I wanted to say is he wrote his greatest philosophy that in English it's called Guide to the Perplexed. It's written in the Arabic language. You know, and Jews, the majority of Jews in the world spoke Arabic. They lived in Arabic-speaking countries for centuries and centuries. Yeah, so this whole idea that Jews and Arabs have been enemies, I mean, that's like just, it's modern propaganda to kind of justify.
Modern
propaganda. Very sadly, what some Jews are doing to Palestinians, and that's been going on for, I'd say started about 100 years ago. It got very intense a little more than 75 years ago. And as we speak today, it's like reaching, it's reaching a level like actually, I think, beyond what was done in 48 to drive more than 2 million people out of their homes and indiscriminately just kill and starve people and actually induce diseases. I just can't even think about it. And even that idea, can't think about it. So that means a lot of people need like a screen so they don't have to think about it. So they come up with this idea like, oh, they'll kill us if we don't kill them first. They even actually did kill some of us.
Now, you being a practicing, obviously, Jewish rabbi, many Jews that I've spoken to, Jewish rabbis, They talk about how Zionism has hijacked Judaism. And here's an interesting historian. He talks about how most Zionists don't believe that God exists, but they do believe that he promised them the land. How ironic. And that, is it true that most of even the Theodor Herzls and the early founders, they didn't also use this argument that to establish this state that they had to establish it for their survival against the Muslims?
They didn't use that argument.
They didn't. They didn't.
No, they didn't. They weren't dealing with that. It hadn't come up in history yet. Yeah. For them, when you talk about Herzl, he was thinking about Christians annihilating Jews. I mean, we're talking about, let's say, when my grandparents were young, right? My grandfather was born in what today is Belarus, and it was rife with pogroms, meaning mobs, armed mobs, attacking defenseless Jews, killing them, raping them, destroying their homes, you know, so they fled from that to America. Thank you very much, America. But that's what Herzl was reacting to. It had nothing to do with Muslims. It wasn't Muslims. It was, I don't even want to say it was Christians, because Christians don't behave like that. People that they're not Christians. I don't care what they call themselves. They're not Christians. But the point is, it had nothing to do with Muslims whatsoever. Whew. And you also brought up something about Judaism itself. I think you might have used the word hijacked. It's very true that Judaism has always maintained a relationship between the Jewish people and that land. I can say the land of our ancestors, for sure. You know, that was a place that we prayed about when we prayed like to be able to be restored to it, but it wasn't being restored by might or force, like we're going to take it over. Being restored to it meant that we were living in like a godly way. And the religious idea was, if we live in a godly way and do the right things in this world, then God will take us back. And that's part of like kind of putting the world back together and kind of like this, I would say like a mythical ideal, the way it should be. Almost like an image of the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it's a historical reality, but it's, again, I think psychology is so important. Like our inner lives really drive what we do, you know. So if you have a belief of a kind of an ideal way that it should be, and that ideal is we'll be back in our land when we live in a right, holy, godly way. Part of the reward for that is we'll get to go back to where we belong. And that was a religious Jewish idea. And for 2,000 years, Jews had that idea and prayed about it and tried to live in a good, holy way. And it wasn't happening. And there were pogroms and there was horrible things going on. So in the late 1800s, in the time of modernity, maybe a different conception of human agency in this world, and less like relying on God to get things done. And in a time when nationalism was rising in Europe, there were Jews who thought, we need to take history into our own hands, right? Not pray about it, not do all these religious obligations or commandments and hope that God does it for us, because that's not working, right? Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, we're getting killed. So we need to take care of this ourselves. And that's the birth of Zionism.
I'm going to get your, we're going to go back to this Michelle Bachmann, who's a former Congress lady who was in the previous clip. I want to see how you, that's why I played that clip, because she's a very influential lady.
I didn't know that's who that was.
Yeah, so many people, here's another clip. And I think one of the wisdoms behind what's happening is we're really getting to see people's true faces and what's in their hearts, and if they even have a heart. So I want to hear this next clip and see how you interpret this.
It's time that Gaza ends. The 2 million people who live there, they are clever assassins. They need to be removed from that land. That land needs to be turned into a national park.
2 million people, clever assassins. I think half of those there are children under the age of 18. How would you translate those what she's spewing out there?
It's just hateful racism. I can't imagine what's going on in her head.
I can't either. I was like, am I crazy here? Is this is like almost inciting genocide. This is
not
a crime
almost.
By international law.
Almost. It is. It is.
It is.
Yeah, it's sick. It's a kind of a psychopathology to think that way about anybody.
She said, clever assassins turn it into an amusement park. I cannot wrap my mind. I said, I don't get it. Well, and like you said, yeah, go ahead.
It's just totally irresponsible. I mean, I would just say
irresponsible, totally
kind
irresponsible.
Kind of like Trump. Just anything can come out of her mouth. She has a thought. She thinks it's going to like impress people and get her some attention. And oh, well, there she is on the Charlie Kirk show. And so she just blurts out whatever she feels like saying. It's completely irresponsible. And it's horrible. We are living in very, very frightening times when people like that can have such a platform and they're taken seriously.
Very scary. I want people to now watch this next clip and tell us your experiences from living in Israel. Did you see some of this? And I want people to just put themselves, until we're able to put ourselves in other people's shoes, to have some empathy, some sympathy, and say, would we allow this for ourselves? Check this out.
We understand that Israeli soldiers came in this morning and without any notice, without any invitation, came into the apartment and have been there ever since.
We cannot speak with you. There is a soldiers.
They're soldiers?
Yes.
What are they doing here?
We are prison here.
What's happening?
They are keeping here, and the soldiers are upstairs. We cannot move. We cannot speak with you.
You can't leave the house?
No.
They told you that?
Yes. I can't breathe.
How long are they going to stay?
I don't know.
Are they paying you any money?
You are kidding.
I'm kidding. Abdel Nasif, the bank manager, said he had to get to his bank to open the safe, but that soldiers won't let him go. He told us when the soldiers come, they wake everybody up and herd them into a kitchen for hours while soldiers sleep in their bedrooms. They can't leave or use the phone or let us in. This time, they kept the women under house arrest, but let the men go to work and the children go to school. When the children returned, we caught a glimpse of two armed soldiers at the top of the stairs.
Sleep in their bedrooms. What is your reaction? And this has been going on for how long?
Oh, for decades.
They can literally come in someone's house and take over their house and sleep in the bedroom?
They can do anything they want. No one's going to stop them, and they do it. I know this personally. I've absolutely seen this. I have my own clips of people. I can use names and places. I could tell you very specifically, going back at least 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it's totally commonplace all the time. Israeli soldiers barge in to families' homes, take over their homes. They often go up on the roof and use the roof as an observation point or even a sniping post. And you could say they use the people in the houses like human shields.
Wow.
And they just ransack the house. I mean, this happens every single night. And it's done for psychological reasons, to simply assert domination and to enforce subjugation, to just show who's boss. We're going to come in here. We're going to tear your house apart. And there's nothing you can do about it.
This is wow. And I, when I, before I showed this, I said, just put yourself in their position. Would we ever allow this to ourselves, to someone? You have your family, your home, your dignity, you have safety in your house. You're the king of your castle, the queen of your house. And now somebody's coming and just taking over and sleeping in your bed. Would we accept that as Americans for ourselves?
I hear you. And
Would anybody?
I want to say, let's hope we never find out. And that question of would you accept? I'll just tell you a little story about me growing up. Please. You know, I heard so much about like the Jews during the Holocaust going like sheep. Like, why did they just go? Why didn't they resist more? Why didn't they fight back? You know, but if you are faced with brutal people with weapons and you have nothing and you're barefoot in your pajamas, are you going to fight back? I heard you, Eddie, right now. You just said like, oh, who would accept this? Like, you don't have a choice. It's not, you don't like, nobody's asking whether you accept it.
Yeah.
Right. 20 guys with guns bash down your door and barge into your house. You don't have a choice. The main person I'm thinking of right now, I'm not going to use her name because she's actually still there. But when Israel built the wall, the famous wall, this is a woman who lives in Bethlehem from a fairly prosperous family. She and her husband and children lived in a house, and they still live in this house, on one side of the main street that went between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. Right across the street was her sister. Next to her sister was her brother. And when the Israelis built the wall that divides Palestine, as it does, they built this wall right in front of her house, right around the side of her house, right around the back side of her house, so that the other side of the wall was like on the side that is where Israel is. And where she was, isolated in her house, is the part that's like the West Bank, where the Palestinians are. She can't move out of her house except one way, walk all along the wall. And when they did that, they also occupied her house. They commandeered it, might be a better word for it. They barged in, they took it over, they stayed there for weeks. And she talked to me like hanging laundry out on the line, like from her balcony with the Israeli soldiers, just sitting on the balcony, them watching over the wall, watching her neighbors you know, ready to snipe them. And that's gone on and on and on. And eventually the Israeli soldiers left, but they're still stuck behind that wall, and they can come back anytime.
Wow.
I would say, honestly, I want to say nothing can stop them. But there is something that can stop them, and I think it actually is American voters and American taxpayers, because all of this is supported by American tax dollars and American political support. And when the U.S. finally gets ready to pull the plug, it's all going to go down the drain.
And this is an important point that I don't think any person who has their humanity on would want their money going towards, what is it, about almost $4 billion yearly?
That's the regular amount. Do you know what Congress is considering right now?
How much?
Another $14 billion, unconditioned. And you know, I'm in Canada, right? I live in Canada. Mm-hmm. That's where I am. Yeah. Israel's gross domestic product per capita is higher than Canada's. Israel has like a higher level of economic activity per capita than Canada does. And the U.S. is giving that aid. I'm just like, I know a lot of your audience is probably in the U.S. People in the U.S. really have to get mobilized. I just want to say, like two or three weeks ago,
yes,
there was a bill in the U.S. Senate to provide $10 billion of unconditioned aid to Israel to, like, you know, finance all the weapons that they're using now that weren't included in the previous aid. And they bundled that bill together with aid to the Ukraine. And 50 Republicans voted against it, and that wouldn't have been enough to stop it, except the one person who joined them was Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. So Bernie Sanders plus 50 Republicans voted against it, and that's what shot it down in the Senate. But now they're trying a different configuration of the bill, trying to get that money through again. The reason I'm talking about that is to say that this stuff is determined by actual decisions made by real people who are elected by the American voters. And everyone who stays home and doesn't vote, you're just turning it over to the other side. And I'm an American. I'm an American who's been living in Canada for 28 years. I'm very active in U.S. politics for this reason. You know, I still vote. I vote in Pennsylvania. And I just want to say, regardless of how bad the choices are, between like worse and even more worse, we still are making a choice. We can, you know, voting for the lesser of two evils is better than not voting at all, because then the worse evil is going to dominate. So again, just thinking about soldiers barging into somebody's house, commandeering it, sleeping in their bed, from that all the way to sending 2,000-pound bombs to destroy people's homes and hospitals, all of that is enabled by U.S. voters not doing better. So I'm going to say, do better. I'm one of them. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to us. We need to do better, and we can put an end to this.
And I'm with Rabbi David here, and those chings that you're hearing is someone live who is messaging him from Gaza, from Palestine. And just a couple more questions. Have you had any success? How have been the conversations when you talk to other Jewish rabbis on the issue? Have you been able to help people get through the cognitive dissonance quicker with your experience? Has there been any success? Can you talk to us briefly on that?
Well, one thing I'd say is it's very polarized, right? You said earlier in this conversation that we're really seeing people's true colors. Mm. So people are kind of needing to get on one side or another of this divide, and it's very divisive. So something we are seeing is there are rabbis who never before have spoken out or done anything to try to rein in the abuses and the horrors that Israel's committing. Who are now doing that? I wish there were more. I wish it would happen faster, but it is happening. I think there's people a bit like me, maybe 15 years ago, where just like the evidence piled up so much that I just could not continue like rationalizing and justifying, and it kind of like the dam broke, you know, and I got kind of swept over to the other side. I think that's happening to more and more rabbis and all kinds of Jewish people. So I am being contacted every day by Jewish people who are, they actually write to me. Someone wrote to me yesterday. I said, I realize everything that I've believed was a lie. Somebody wrote that to me. And now what do I do?
This is from another Jewish person.
Yes, there's lots of them. Lots of them.
Beautiful.
I just want to actually say straight out loud, like an organization I'm active with in the States is called Jewish Voice for Peace. And it's been around maybe 15 or 20 years. It had about 200,000 members, but more and more and more people are just coming out and joining us. You probably see this. You see lots and lots of Jewish people going into public spaces like, you know, Grand Central Station or bridges and really demonstrating our,
not in our name, not in our name.
Right. I thought about wearing my not in our name t-shirt today, but I didn't wear it. But you asked me was, am I having some success in changing people's minds? And I have to say, I don't see that directly. And it's a kind of thing where I think it's, well, I'm not in that conversation with specific individuals, but yes, many, many, many people are seeing what's going on, and it's finally adding up to them that they cannot support it. They cannot go on like with their acquiescence to just let it be. So many, many, many Jewish people are feeling, honestly, the like pangs of conscience based on all the teachings of Judaism about pursuing justice, pursuing peace, about every person is an image of God. When we say we're created in the image of God, we are an image of God. And anyone being abused or hurt is abusing and hurting God. This is in our teachings. So more and more and more people are putting two and two together and saying, what's actually happening right now? It's such a violation, and I cannot stand idly by. I need to engage. And it's very painful to see that the communities, the synagogues that we are a part of and that we identify with are on such the wrong side, you know, and it's forcing people to make a choice. It's very difficult. I mean, I'm not looking for sympathy, right? Because other people are getting bombed and don't have anything to eat. I'm not saying feel bad for people facing this difficult choice, but it is difficult, and more people are making that choice. It's I don't think things are ever going to go back to the way they were.
As we wrap up now, I just have couple more questions as we're almost out of time. We covered a lot. We dispelled this myth, this lie that this has been something that Muslims, it's a Muslim versus Jew things. Muslims and Jews lived in relative peace for over 1,000 years. We discussed the situation, the Nakba, 1948, the over almost 800,000 people that were driven out their homes. So people can look more into this. You mentioned human shields. I've also had a Dr. Norman Finkelstein, another Jewish academic professor, and he addressed this. You mentioned how when the video showing the soldiers going into the house, and then you gave it also example of the human shield. And it's interesting that Amnesty International, as Dr. Norman Finkelstein and other human rights organizations, they say it's actually flipped the other way around. Like you just said, that they're using the Palestinians as human shield, but this is a common argument. So my next question is, how do you address this? And then we can go ahead and conclude, is that prior after 2006, they pulled out. They could have made this a beautiful resort and it could have been a paradise on earth. And you get this, you hear this a lot, right? This is another one of the talking points that there was no occupation. There is no occupation. They pulled out in 2005, 2006.
No.
How would you address that?
No. What do you mean specifically is that Israel withdrew its military and the settlers from Gaza. When you say they pulled out in 2006, you're saying they pulled out from Gaza. Yeah, so, you know, there's an Israeli professor who said that that is very analogous to the guards at a jail basically going home at night, right? They have the keys. Mm. The prisoners are on the inside. They have the keys, but they left the jail. They all went home, but they left the prisoners on the inside. And the guards control how much food goes in, what can come out. When anybody can come out, if someone is sick, they have cancer or they have kidney disease or God knows whatever is going on, would you let that prisoner out to go to a hospital? Or do they just have to stay in there and die? Right? So to say that Israel withdrew from Gaza, it's just another kind of sleight of hand. It's not true. They turned Gaza into basically a huge concentration camp. And not only that, but Israel constantly surveils with drones. Constantly. Israel knows where everyone is in Gaza. That's why they're able to kill the doctors, the heads of hospitals, the presidents of universities, over 100 journalists. They know where everyone is. And they didn't really withdraw. They control the land borders. Egypt is subservient to Israel. There's one little part of Gaza that borders on Egypt and is Egypt serves Israel's interest. Egypt is bribed to do that by $3 billion in U.S. foreign aid every year, second only to Israel, right? Israel controls the sea, the air, the land, controls the water supply, as we see, the electric supply. And Israel has kept Gaza very explicitly, they say this, basically on a slightly above starvation diet up until 10 weeks ago when they just shut that off. So it's not true to say that Israel withdrew.
Wow. This is people are getting a totally different perspective. What is it currently now, the amount of civilians that have, what is the number that have been killed? And also including in that, is that journalists, UN workers?
Sure.
Do you know the numbers?
Well, it's something like 23,000.
We're up to 23,000.
I want to say 23,000 people identified as dead. I know specific families whose loved ones are under the rubble. In other words,
that's not counted in there. So it could be
people who they were in their house when their house was hit by a missile. They got out.
So those are,
they got out those, the bodies of their children, but they have other children that they can't even get them out.
So those are not included. So we got people, we don't even know what's going on with them. They're still under the rubble.
Whatever the number is, Eddie, it's going up today. It went up last night. These women who I told you I'm hearing from in Mahazi camp, there was over 100 people killed in Mahazi camp yesterday. And this one woman, I said her name is Iman, she stayed in her house. You know, they were all told to leave and go to the south. So the other woman named Mesa with two children, she left and went to the south and there's nowhere to go. She didn't have anywhere to go there, you know, and Iman said they're not leaving because nowhere is safe. It doesn't make sense to leave. She's been in her house for something like 6 weeks with no windows, no doors, holes in the roof, no water, nothing to cook on, nothing to cook. But they didn't leave their house. And Mesa left her house. She went first to Khan Yunis, and then she went from Khan Yunis to Rafah. And she was basically staying in a tent. And then the day before yesterday, she went back to Mahazi because, like Iman said, nowhere is safe. It wasn't helping her to be in Rafah. And then each of them, they actually don't know each other. They live very near each other, but they don't know each other. I'm just saying. So last night while I was asleep, Iman wrote to me and she said that now they're getting these leaflets telling them they need to leave Mahazi because Mahazi is going to be flattened. Wow. And she has nowhere to go. And then about 2 hours after that, I woke up and I wrote to Mesa, Mesa, how are you doing? You know, what's going on? And she wrote back to me. She said the exact same thing, that they have been forced out of like the ruins of the refugee camp that she lived in her whole life with nowhere to go. She has two little kids. And her house was so damaged 2 years ago, there was hit in the middle of the night. She actually grabbed her two kids in a mattress and ran out in the street and slept in the street and then couldn't go back. And I did fundraising. Oh, I'll say it. You can edit this out if you want. Kyrie Irving gave money that helped this young woman, Mesa, rebuild her house.
Kyrie Irving.
Kyrie Irving. She rebuilt her house and moved back in about the third week of September. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks later, this happened, and her house is gone. Her house is gone. She's nowhere. She went back to Mahazi, but there's no house there for her to be in. Mm-hmm. And as of this morning, she left and she wrote to me. I could pull up the clips that I get from her. I mean, you can see this on my Facebook Messenger.
He's been very outspoken also, Kyrie Irving, regarding this, hasn't he?
You know, I'm not going to lie to you guys. A lot of stuff is going on in this world, and basketball is just not the most important thing to me right now. There's a lot of stuff going on overseas. All my people are still in bondage. It's sad to see this shit going on. And it's not just in Palestine. It's not just in Israel. Discriminated against based on their religion, color of their skin, what they believe in. It's just sad.
He's really been somebody who is, many are scared of getting canceled and, you know, to speak up, more concerned about their careers rather than humanity. But Kyrie's really been stand up on this.
Literally, he put his money where his mouth is.
Stand up human being, yes.
He put his money where his mouth is. And the money is a way to concretize your wishes. And, you know, you want something? You want this young woman in Gaza to have a house? You want that? You can make that happen if you have the ways and means, you know? So anyway, I want to more talk about them and what's going on there. So they have, right now, I mean, when I finish talking with you, I'm going to go back and try to reconnect with them. And I don't know if I'll be able to.
Let's close off with this. I know I'm not going to speak for Canadians, but I know as an American here that we would never, never, ever agree with if a school shooter came into an auditorium, a elementary high school, and he took over, that we would say it would be acceptable just to blow up the entire school. Unacceptable. How about in Canada?
Yeah, I think Canadians have that attitude.
Yeah.
No, seriously. You know, but at the same time, Canada's government is just lockstep with Israel. Right? You said Canadians. Canadians have a certain way of seeing things. But our Canadian government is, it's not helping.
I want to say God bless you, Rabbi David. God bless you.
Well,
thank you.
God bless you too. And, you know, clearly there's more going on in this world than what we know, and certainly much more than what we can control, you know, and we each need to do our piece of what we can do and have faith and know there's something bigger going on here. It's not just us, right? We have to do our part, you know, but there's something greater going on, and really, really, God willing, that will kick in.
God willing.
Yeah. And that's it.
Inshallah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.
I have no doubt that bi'ithnillahi ta'ala it will be a successful project, inshallah. I've had the blessing of knowing Brother Eddie since he started the Deen Show, and he is one of the most sincere and most dedicated people to the da'wah that I have ever met. So please do support the Deen Center. Jazakumullahu khairan.
I cannot leave without giving you a gift. If you're not yet Muslim and you're tuning in to see what these Muslims are talking about, and you like a free copy of the Quran, go ahead and visit thedeanshow.com. We'll take care of the postage and everything and get it delivered to you. And if you still have some questions,
about Islam, call us at 1-800-662-4752. We'll see you next time. Until then, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.